This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, back with more of The Awful Truth on Radio EcoShock. Let me ask you, do you have days when you feel like we're doomed as a species? That's every day for our next guest. When a successful professor of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology left the University of Arizona for his mud hut retreat, he probably didn't intend to stir up the world. But that's just what Guy McPherson has done. He's become a voice for the worst fears of many scientists. In fact, McPherson says climate change has gone so far, so fast, humans will become extinct before 2050. Dr. McPherson makes his case and offers ways to cope with the ultimate bad news in a new book co-authored with psychologist Carolyn Baker. It's called Extinction Dialogues, Living with Death in Mind. That's coming out this fall. Let's find out why Guy McPherson thinks we are finished. Guy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, so you're just back from Belize. What was going on there?
I was just doing a little consulting work. People are developing homesteads, and I developed what I consider the platinum-grade homestead here in New Mexico. So I have a little practical, hands-on experience, as well as the initials that follow my name that some people think are important. So people ask me to show up in exchange for travel expenses. I'll provide advice on just about anything.
And I gather you have been telling people around the country and beyond that we're heading for a fatal shift of the climate. How is that being received?
Well, it depends a lot. I would say a vast majority of the people, probably in the range of three-quarters or so of the people, push back pretty hard with comments like that can't happen to us, we're too clever, it hasn't happened yet, so clearly it'll never happen. People have been saying the same kind of thing for thousands of years, and look, here we are, still here. So there's a lot of pushback. On the other hand, relatively few people take in the evidence I present, absorb it, and then live differently, live as if the day were here, to quote Nietzsche, and try to experience deeply each moment. And so it seems that there's two ends of the spectrum and very little in between.
Is anyone in the mainstream media willing to talk about this guy?
Well, I'm not sure. I think mainstream is maybe a continuum rather than the end of a line or a box to fit in. Dar Jamal, who wrote a couple of books based on his experience as an unembedded journalist in Iraq, is writing about it. And Tom Hartman and Abby Martin both had me on their television shows with RT. Not exactly MSNBC, but they do have a considerable reach.
Yeah, I think Hartman and RT, that's getting there once you get some television talk going about it. I'd like to get to some of the science, and I know this is a huge topic. I've gone through some of the science that you've put out, and you do take care to collect science from all over the world. Could you say who are the leading scientists that drive you to conclude we cannot survive global warming?
Well, Tim Garrett's epic paper written 7 years ago, and I know you've had him on your show, his paper from that he wrote seven years ago that was actually published in November 2009 online and then finally made print media in February 2011, that's a great piece of work indicating that civilization is a heat engine. And then until we terminate civilization, we're always going to be ratcheting up the damage. There is quite a bit of evidence at this point from the likes of Paul Beckwith, for example, that we're headed for the abyss, although Paul would not use those words and perhaps doesn't even believe that we are headed for our own extinction, even though he predicts up to 16 C temperature rise within a couple of decades, and that prediction was made more than a year ago. In any event, those are a couple of the names. Beyond that, I comb the refereed journal literature, and I come across names like Jason Box, who mostly studies ice on Greenland, but he's been interviewed on broader topics recently. And then the refereed journal literature from, you know, Nature and Science and Geophysical Research Letters and Proceeds in the National Academy of Sciences, and on and on and on it goes. So when you put all the information together, it appears that First of all, the clathrate gun has been fired.
Now, we should clarify that. What's the clathrate gun, please?
Right. So the clathrate gun is the phenomenon James Hansen worried about most in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. It's the topic most studied by climate scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa. And it refers to the clathrates or hydrates, those are synonyms, which are chemical cages around methane molecules in the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. So those clathrates or hydrates, with a little bit of warming, start to bubble up to the surface, and then the hydrate breaks, the chemical chain breaks, and releases the methane into the ocean, or worse yet, directly into the atmosphere. And it's methane that has been implicated in many of the major extinction events, that carbon dioxide drives the show for a while, atmospheric carbon dioxide. But then at some point, the methane is released from the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean and also from permafrost, from under the boreal forests of the world. So those two in combination, those two major sources of methane in combination, have been major contributors to extinction events in the past. They both seem to be going full scale at this point.
Well, I could add a couple of names to this list. I mean, Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA, has wondered whether there are any limits to climate change, and he studied Venus and thinks that it's possible, not likely, but possible, that we could blow off the atmosphere altogether, and that would certainly lead to the extinction of all life as we know it. And then you have conferences like the 4 degrees or more conference in Australia. John Schellenhuber from Germany suggested if we reach 4 degrees, the whole thing could easily slide to 8 degrees. He listed some physics reasons, which I didn't totally understand, but he does. And I think we could agree that 8 degrees is beyond the level of human tolerance, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. I have my serious questions about human surviving 4 C, for the simple reason that humans have never experienced life on this planet at 3.5 C above baseline, meaning the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. At 4 C, according to quite a bit of the journalist literature out there, at 4 C, all we can prepare for is extinction.
No. Many of the big-name scientists, though, other than James Lovelock, hedged their warnings with the idea we could still save ourselves if we mount a huge campaign to switch energy to renewables and stop our carbon-wasting ways. Guy, why do you say it's too late for all that?
Because it seems pretty clear to me that the clathrate gun has been fired based on refereed journal articles in Science and Nature and geophysical research letters, and the list goes on, as well as NASA's CARV project. That appears to be a self-reinforcing feedback loop. And on the topic of self-reinforcing feedback loops, there's another 36 to go in addition to that one. And they not only feed themselves, that is, as methane is released, it gets warmer, and that allows for increased methane release from the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. Not only that, but as warm Atlantic water is defrosting the Arctic by shooting through the Fram Strait off the north and east coast of Greenland, that causes an increased warming of the Arctic Ocean and therefore allows the release of more methane. So these are phenomena that are not only feeding themselves, but they're feeding among other feedbacks as well.
Yeah, I can think, too, of things like Arctic fires. They're larger every year due to climate change, and their soot causes more and earlier melting, and that leads to an extended fire season, and that leads to more fires. And this is one of the things that I really do appreciate about your work, Guy McPherson, because you are adding up these positive feedback effects where it seems like the scientists that I talk to are all working on one or the other, and they don't look at how they intermingle. Is that your opinion as well?
Yes, absolutely. And a big part of that is because of the way our society works generally and the way academia works specifically. You get rewarded in academia for the silo you settle into and for gaining some notoriety within that relatively small silo. And there is little to no interaction across the silos, despite university administrators' comments to the contrary. In the more than 2 decades I was at universities, I didn't see any significant encouragement for people from different departments to interact with each other. And in fact, instead, I saw plenty of discouragement for people who were trying to pursue such a path.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guest, Dr. Guy McPherson. He says the human species will be wiped out by our own careless pollution. Now, Guy, one place where you and I disagree is that as far as I understand it, you've given a specific year for human extinction. When is that, and how do you arrive at a date?
Well, instead of providing my own date, I continue to present the evidence developed by other scientists. So the only analysis I've seen of the class rate done indicates more than 4C warming by 2030. That's based on an exponential projection of temperature going forward from the firing of the class rate gun in maybe 2010 or so. It appears now that the class rate gun probably was fired in 2007. So that goes to more than 4C by 2030. Paul Beckwith's analysis indicates 6C within a decade. That was from late 2012, which I don't see any way for humans to survive 6C, considering we've never been on the planet when it was 3.5 degrees C above baseline in the past. And Beckwith goes on a year later to predict 16C within a decade or two. And that takes us to, 2033, I guess, with 16C. And that's the latest possible date for that prediction, would be 2033. So I think 2030 is not an unreasonable date to expect extinction of our species. I don't see any way, really, we make it till 2040 or 2050, given that these feedbacks are reinforcing among themselves as well as within themselves. And both of those analyses, the exponential analysis by San Corana, the prior analysis by Malcolm Light, and then the two separate analyses and predictions by Paul Beckwith, all of those are based solely on the single feedback of methane being released from the shallow Arctic Ocean.
So I know that many listeners are already raising objections, and I'm sure that you've heard them all in your talks. But first of all, I want to ask you, how rigorous are you in your definition of extinct? Do you mean civilization disappears, leaving a few stragglers near the Arctic Circle, as James Lovelock suggested? Or do you mean not a single member of the human species left on the planet?
I'm a conservation biologist, and when I say extinct, I mean every member of the species is gone.
Wow. Personally, I think the climate is too complex with too many unknowns to predict if we will become extinct, much less when. But, Guy, consider this. The whole scientific world is surprised Earth didn't warm as fast as they thought, given the huge amounts of carbon we've been emitting. Some call it a warming hiatus due to the heat being absorbed by the ocean. What do you think about that?
I think scientists, not surprisingly, have not been paying attention to their own refereed journal literature. And this is a classic case. I keep hearing about this hiatus, and it's just not there. It is just absolutely not there. Completely contrary to the contrarian myth, global warming has accelerated with more overall global warming since 1997 than the period before then. And we've known this now since a paper was published in March of 2013 in Geophysical Research Letters. And yet, I don't see any reference to it in the refereed journal literature or in presentations given by climate scientists. So there hasn't been a pause, as it's often called. Instead, there's been a pause in land surface records, but that's less than a third of the planet. The heat has been going into the ocean. We know it's been going into the ocean since March of 2013. It's time for scientists to wake up and start reading their own literature. It's absurd to me that we keep hearing about this hiatus or pause when, in fact, there's been an acceleration, a rapid acceleration, even going to the deep ocean down below several hundred meters. It's pretty hard to warm up the deep ocean, but the acceleration of the heating of the deep ocean has persisted since 1997 when there was a so-called pause. Now, bear in mind, then in 1997, that's the date many people point toward as the start of the pause or the hiatus. Well, in 1997, there was a pretty profound El Nino event. So land surface temperatures reached a really, really high level at the time, an all-time high level. And so when we see the next El Nino event, whenever that is, we're going to see a tremendous amount of heat released by the ocean, and land surface records are going to skyrocket, I suspect, to a new all-time record.
Yeah, you're talking about one of the scariest things for me, because the Australian climate scientist Matthew England studied this overturning of ocean currents in the Pacific. And he says such benefits of sort of hiding the warming somewhat cannot last more than about a decade. And given what we know about these ocean cycles, the hiatus, if there is one, won't happen again for more than a century. So all that backlog of heating that we've created could hit us before 2030 and won't stop again this century. You know, I wish it was the other way around, that somehow heating hit us too hard, too fast, and then we'd wake up and do something about it. But instead, it's almost being hidden by this natural process. I'm worried about it.
I think you're justifiably worried about it. I think it's cause for major concern. And I don't see very many people in positions of influence being concerned about it or expressing that concern in any event.
Well, let's try and picture this road to extinction. You said it could happen pretty quickly, perhaps just 25 years from now. As a professor with expertise in evolutionary biology, you have serious expertise. Can you try to describe a scenario that would wipe us out? And take a little time if you need it.
Well, it's all about habitat. So clearly we are capable of adapting to pretty warm temperatures, especially using the tools of industrial civilization. So it's not that we can't go from a really cold day outside, walk into the inside of a building, and experience a 30°C temperature rise in a matter of a few seconds. We do that pretty regularly in the wintertime or here in the summertime when we go from inside to out. Rather, the problem is one of habitat. And so here again is where an ecological background is beneficial. We need habitat, and we don't just need air and water, we need food too. Again, based on the Refereed Journal literature, there's a 30% increase in the acidification of the oceans within the last few decades based on a 0.85°C rise in temperature, and that carbon dioxide being pushed into the ocean at that higher temperature. And we talked about the heat being stored in the ocean right now. And that's having major consequences for marine life, for almost all marine life. It could be that in the relatively near future, again, based on the Refereed Journal literature, we have an ocean that's full of jellyfish and not much else. In fact, there's a recent line from the author of a paper, and I'm not going to be able to come up with a reference off the top of my head, but again, it's in the Refereed Journal literature, and the author concludes that we could lose all of the ocean's phytoplankton in the relatively near future. Well, that's the base of the marine food web, and loss of the marine food system for humans means loss of about half our food. The other half comes in the form of land plants, one way or another, and we're already seeing devastating impacts on land plants, again, at 0.85°C. The so-called polar vortex or Rossby wave or meandering of the jet stream is responsible for large-scale destruction of the winter vegetables in Mexico, in the southwest United States, and also death of a lot of citrus trees in the same region. And that's just at 0.85°C. So we have this meandering jet stream that takes cold air from the Arctic and drags it way further south than we've ever experienced in the last several thousand years at least. And at the same time, we see very warm weather being dragged up north into areas that are supposed to be cold in the wintertime. The combination for plants that have developed adaptations for a particular place is truly devastating. So we're seeing large-scale reduction of all kinds of organisms throughout the world, but especially in the northern hemisphere, where that meandering jet stream comes into play so strongly. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if within a decade or two, we managed to destroy virtually all land plants in the world because of these tremendous fluctuations in temperature at a local level.
Did the three nuclear meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan, add to your sense that we won't make it? Is that part of the story?
Absolutely. If we maintain industrial civilization into the future, we cause so much heating, again, as Tim Garrett's work has pointed out, that it drives us to our own extinction. And it looks like, in fact, we've already triggered so much damage that's irreversible that we're already headed for extinction as a result of climate change. If we shut down industrial civilization, on the other hand, that means that we experience the catastrophic meltdown of the world's 400 and change nuclear power facilities. And just Fukushima alone represents a significant threat to habitat for humans in the northern hemisphere. So the fact that it takes at least 20 years, and according to David Jasko, I think that's his first name, most recent ex-head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States, according to him, it'll take up to 60 years, maybe more, to shut down Indian Point nuclear power plant. Well, if there's one thing I'm relatively certain of, it's that we don't have 60 years left of industrial civilization. And even if we did, I don't see any leadership that is causing people to decommission nuclear power plants. Rather, we're commissioning new ones, at least in this country, rather than decommissioning them. I think that ought to be priority one for anybody in a position of leadership, is to immediately start decommissioning, shutting down safely nuclear power plants around the world. But I don't see any evidence of that happening.
All right. Now, two quick objections that I know you've heard 1,000 times. Optimists suggest a human awakening could happen, and the world connected by social media could happen really quickly. And they give the example of the Second World War, when America stopped making automobiles overnight and the whole population accepted massive change. Do you discount that kind of last-minute turnaround?
I have serious reservations about what that would look like. Are we asking people to terminate civilization? Because according to the Referee Journal literature, that's what it takes to prevent runaway greenhouse. I suspect runaway greenhouse is already underway based on several analyses. But let's say it's not. Are we going to convince 7 billion people in the world that they can't have any of their toys anymore? That we can't have water running through the taps? That we can't have food delivered to the grocery store or gasoline to the gas stations? I just don't see any way that 7 billion people are going to vote for that.
Yeah, there's a little voice in me saying, hell no, we'd rather die first. And we may. Well, what about technology? Some people hope we'll invent a machine to remove carbon or at least use geoengineering to cool the planet. How can you be sure we won't save ourselves that way?
Well, there's no such thing as 100% certainty, of course. So it could be that the miracle shows up and we come up with some civilized means to reverse the damages being caused by civilization. It could happen. I don't see much evidence of that on the horizon. People have been working on that for a while. Geoengineering has been discredited widely in the Referee Journal literature, and even the people don't seem to be on board on it based on poll results. So I don't think geoengineering is the answer. I don't know what the answer is, but I suspect attempting to use tools of civilization, which is the root of the problem. Civilization is the root of the problem, as Tim Garrett's work points out. So trying to create tools from civilization to solve this predicament induced by civilization seems like it's headed the wrong direction to me.
Okay, now just shifting topics a little bit. After Kolapnik and radio host Michael C. Ruper took his own life this year, people in the climate movement stopped to consider their own mental health, and I'll be talking about that with your co-author Carolyn Baker. But has it been hard for you too?
Which part?
Well, just realizing that, we're doomed, as you think. It must be tough.
Oh, yes. I thought you were referring specifically to the death of my friend, Mike Rupert, which was hard on me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, is it hard knowing that we don't have as long as I thought we would? The typical sort of professorial life for those who are successful in the academy, for those who make full professor, for example, as I did, is to persist in that career until the age of 70 or so, and then retire and happily travel around the world during the golden years of retirement. Well, when I hit the age of 70, that'll be the year 2030. Either we won't have civilization or we won't have habitat for humans at that point, and I suspect both, in fact. So things didn't work out quite as I'd planned when I got into this game. On the other hand, I'm a conservation biologist, and I've known for a very long time that I was going to die and that all species go extinct. Obviously, that doesn't make it any easier beyond intellectually, but I have had a relatively long time to take into account those ideas. So when I deliver presentations now, I try to encourage people to live with death in mind. And in fact, that's the subtitle of the book by Carolyn Baker and I, is How to Live with Death in Mind. I'm trying to take some of my own advice for a change and take advantage of each moment and live and breathe deeply in those moments and to experience life as probably I could have and should have always been experiencing it, rather than waiting for the tomorrow that never comes.
Pretty sound advice, I think. Does this book include your long list of scientific reasons why climate change has entered an unstoppable runaway state? Does it include notes to the original source material so readers can check for themselves?
Yes, and in fact, for the last couple of weeks, I've been checking and rechecking every one of the hundreds of citations in the book, and I'm about two-thirds of the way through. It looks like I have another 10 or 12 hours yet to go in checking those citations and making sure they're all in a place that anybody who has access to a library or a computer can track down the founding documents.
Guy McPherson, I've heard you're starting a radio show. What's that about?
The radio show has been broadcast 4 or 5 times already. It's a weekly show, Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM. I'm co-hosted with my friend Michael Sliva. Mike and his wife, Karen, walked away from their very successful positions as high school teachers 3 years ago and came out and spent 3 months with me here at the Mud Hut in New Mexico. So Mike and I have had many long conversations that we think are about important topics, and we wanted to make sure everybody had an opportunity to listen in on our conversations because we think they're really pretty important. And so we have a radio show on PRN.FM.
Well, I'll put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.info so people can find you. Can you tell listeners where to find your popular blog, Nature Bats Last, and your Facebook or Twitter connections if you have any?
Sure, and they're all accessible at the blog, which is guymcpherson.com. No A's in McPherson, but I suspect even if you spell it wrong, you'll find it with only a click or two. And they're... are links there to all the social media I'm engaged in. I have a couple of Facebook pages and a Twitter page, and you can find them all there at guymcpherson.com.
Our guest has been Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona. He left his academic career to specialize in the future of humanity and then found we don't have much of a future left. His new book, co-authored with Carolyn Baker, is Extinction Dialogues, Living with Death in Mind. Guy, where can people find out more about the book?
They can go to Taeyen Lane Publishing's website, taeyenlane.com, T-A-Y-E-N-L-A-N-E, taeyenlane.com, or they can go to, again, guymcpherson.com and click on the tab that says My Books or something like that, and it'll take you down the list of my books, and the last one is the forthcoming book with Carolyn Baker.
This is Alex Smith, Guy McPherson. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure, as always.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.